Good morning. It's 8:06, and we have Erica Martine with the ABC Forecast Center on the line to give us a weather update. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning. This is meteorologist Erica Martine, Park City right now. Conditions are dry, but it looks like some showers are lingering just to the north and west. So I can't clear you completely for showers today, but by the second half of the day, we'll certainly clear you then. Good news, expected high temperature only in the upper 50s for today. By tomorrow, we're going to start to rebound into those daily highs, back to, I'd say, late spring feeling at least. Overnight low tonight in the low 40s, still keeping extra clouds around. So I'm going to go with a mostly cloudy night for Park City. Now, by tomorrow, an area of high pressure starts to influence our region right here. Now, Park City, lots of sunshine in the forecast for you tomorrow. 74 is your expected high temperature, and then 78 on Thursday. That's when we're really going to start to see some showers moving through. I have gone with the threat of an isolated shower late Friday. It just looks like a little bit of a monsoonal influence there. So I'm going to go ahead and go with mostly clear skies to start the day on Friday, a high of 80 degrees, overnight lows in the low 50s. And we could see an evening pop-up thunderstorm. Independence Day brings us lots of sunshine in the forecast. Highs in low 80s, I say 82 degrees, overnight lows in the mid-50s, 55. And then on Sunday, we hit 83 degrees, overnight low at 52. And then on Monday, we're seeing a sunny sky, highs in the low to mid-80s. And it looks like for that stretch, conditions look pretty decent. Now, I initially had a couple of extra clouds on Sunday, so I'll keep you updated for the second half of Sunday into Monday. But right now, it looks like lots of sunshine on the forecast, highs in the 80s. So we just have to deal with cooler temperatures for today, a little bit cooler tomorrow, and then we start to rebound back to normal by the end of this week, certainly into this upcoming weekend. So enjoy.
Thank you, Erica.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Heber City Planning Commission approved new code to regulate lighting of signs in the city. KPCW's David Boyle has more.
And focused on bringing the city into compliance with dark sky initiatives. The International Dark Sky Association has outlined light zones that range from a 0 rating to a 4, 0 representing wilderness, and 4 representing urban areas such as New York City. City planner Jamie Barron recommended the city aim for level 1.
We are a rural area, even though we are obviously seeing more demand on growth. One of the things we heard from Envision Heber process is how do we preserve that rural feel while we grow. And this is one issue that the council has looked at, and you know, this is the way we preserve that rural feel. So the L1 is what we base the lighting recommendations off.
The city has not previously had any code to regulate the amount of light output from signs. City staff proposed a code update to bring regulations on lighting of signs. Key components to the update included code requirements regarding shielding of light fixtures, prompt repair of exposed signs, and a curfew of 11 p.m. or 30 minutes after the business closes. All requirements are to be certified by an independent contractor. The item was part of a public hearing, but no public comment was given. Planning commissioners debated whether to continue the item in order to allow input from sign companies, but ultimately decided to move forward with the dark sky ordinance. Here's Commissioner Dennis Gunn.
We get something in place and then somebody doesn't like it, so they come back and then we bring it back up and we debate it again for 3 months and then we put it in place and then the next sign doesn't work. I think as long as it meets dark sky compliant, the biggest concern that I've heard tends to always come back to the fact that they can be way too bright, which is not a joke, but it can be. And then, of course, they're moving and all that stuff for noise. Some people are just annoyed that anything exists. I think we pretty well beat this horse to death. I mean, there's not much left but a bunch of hair laying all around and other biscuits and things.
Heber Planning Commission voted unanimously to approve the code change. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
Good morning. It's 8:10. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. On the line, I have Tom Fisher, Summit County Manager, to give us an update and, I guess, a preview of tomorrow's meeting. Good morning, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Carolyn. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Thank you. So before we get started on the agenda, let's just briefly talk about fireworks. It looks like there's only one show planned. It's a private show in the basin, and it's being done in a private neighborhood, the Glen Wild, north of I-80 and Promontory. Will those fireworks be visible for the common folks to enjoy?
I have no idea about that. All that we're tracking from a county perspective is that it looks like Glen Wild and perhaps Promontory have been have received a permit from the Park City Fire District to do those. That's all I know at this point. I don't know where they do those in their developments or whether those can be seen from other areas or not.
Okay. And I guess this recent rain is probably a good sign for that type of
activity. Oh, absolutely. I mean, certainly having 3 days of rain leading into a 4th of July weekend, where we do have heightened risk just because of people that do things with personal fireworks, even though they may not be sanctioned by the state, they still happen. People take risks out there that we may not want them to do, but certainly this level of water helps.
Yeah, and there are restrictions on when the fireworks can also start for those using them.
Yeah, there's, and unfortunately I don't know the specifics on that, but yes, there's certain days beforehand and days afterwards that those are allowed, and those are usually surrounding the Independence Day holiday, as well as Pioneer Day later in the month.
Okay. So let's talk about the agenda. The community development block grants are given out on an annual basis, but some money is being given out under the COVID-related CARES Act. And it goes to businesses in Summit and Wasatch County with less than 20 employees that were impacted by COVID. How much money is available?
Well, sure. So the first allocation of COVID funds, and these monies came as a block grant to essentially both Wasatch County and Summit County, that is administered by the Mountain Lands Association of Governments. Approximately $207,000 was allocated to businesses in Summit County, and then a further allocation of these same funds, or very similar funds, are coming to MAG to be administered to the two counties again, about $450,000. So we should be seeing that working through its system very soon. We've also, the county has also received an allocation of CARES Act relief funds that's come through the state. There is plans by the county council to also work with MAG to provide businesses with some similar businesses, nonprofits, especially nonprofits, because we have a little bit more flexibility with the money that came to the county, to use a similar program, similar criteria that's being developed right now through the Mountain Lands Association of Governments and Summit County to allocate some of that money to businesses as well.
And just to clarify, is that additional money to the $450,000 that you just mentioned?
Yes, it's additional to all of those further those allocations that have already come through MAG. This is an allocation that came to the county specifically for community relief, and it in our case the rules are strict that it has to be. It can't go to residential needs or private citizen needs. It has to go to business or nonprofit. We're working on how much of that will be allocated to a program like that and over what period of time.
And have the businesses been selected?
Oh, no, we haven't gotten that far with that yet. Okay. The businesses have been selected for the tranches of money that have already come to MAG for distribution, but for the county funds, it has not.
Okay.
We will be announcing those processes as we develop them.
Okay. And what discussion are you expecting from council tomorrow then?
So really this was to highlight what has already been coming to business through these programs and what processes businesses have had to go through. We're always concerned that especially when some of this money comes in a very fast time frame, that it gets distributed in a fair way. So we want to really highlight how that's happening, and then maybe even have a discussion about what limitations were put on that money when it was allocated, and what the further needs might be out there in the community. Jeff Jones, who has been keeping very close track of these processes and participating in them, it has a very good idea of what needs are still out there, and where we might direct some of the county allocations of the CARES Act so that we can continue to help our broader community as much as possible.
Okay. And then under SB 95, they're making available something called rural county grants for the third to sixth class county. Summit is a third class county. But to get the money.
I think this is part of the state's initiative to do more rural economic development. And of course, this was all done before and legislated and monies allocated in the budget before the COVID pandemic really hit. And I'll explain that in a second. But essentially, they're asking that local economic development boards be set up that can direct monies from the state towards rural economic development projects specifically. And so through a process of both setting up that board, which the council has the ability to do under this legislation, as well as some initial allocations of monies, those boards will work with our rural communities in setting up economic development plans that center on projects to encourage economic development, whether those be in the ground infrastructure or property or other types of projects that could help, even if fiber is a need, for instance. Then once those plans are in place and the boards are set up, they can compete for further state funding to actually implement those projects. Okay. Unfortunately, some of the funding has been cut for this current year. Originally, the initial grants were going to be $200,000 to get those processes started. They've been reduced to $95,000, and there's not further money allocated in the revised state budget to grant for project implementation at this time. But the legislation's still in place, so we want to get the mechanisms in place, or at least we're suggesting to the council that we want to get the mechanism in place to be able to compete in the future.
So would council assign that advisory board then? Would they select, or would you set up an application?
Yeah, similar to other boards that we deal with that have a specific advisory role to the council, I believe they would assign that. There are some criteria within the legislation of what types of people need to be serving on that board. And if council gives us the go-ahead to start working on that, we'll then start a process to recruit and bring forward both an ordinance and a slate of candidates for the council to interview.
Okay, and the $95,000 that you mentioned dropped from $200,000, but that would be used eventually for projects to enhance rural economic development.
Yeah, I think initially it would be used to set up a planning effort to develop the projects that Summit County could then compete for further funding. I think that will be the initial use of that money.
Okay. And then the auditor presents the certified tax rates. It's an annual ritual. Can you explain what happens here and will we see any tax increases?
Sure. I'll have to defer to the auditor as far as tax increase question. But on an annual basis, the council has to certify the tax rates for all of the property tax entities within the county. And that's what this process is. So the auditor presents, based on information from the assessor's office on the property tax list for the county, and information for each of the taxing entities, presents those rates to the council each year for certification, and then those become what the treasurer bases tax bills on, both information from the assessor's office on property and then the tax rates. Those are calculated by the treasurer's office, and then those are result in the tax bill that people receive in the late part of the year.
Okay. And you can't say whether or not we're looking at an increase for this year in property values.
I don't believe there's any entities that are looking at a tax rate increase at this point. Very generally speaking, property values are still going up, which means that most tax rates will actually adjust down in order to make sure that those the levels of property tax revenue remain the same coming to the taxing entities.
Okay. A public hearing on amendments for the Silver Creek Village Center development agreements. The applicant is developer Matt Lowe, but isn't Scott Loomis from Mountainlands Housing Trust also one of the developers?
Well, he is a the Mountainlands Community Housing Trust is a developer within the project on certain parcels. So is Habitat for Humanity and some private developers as well.
Okay.
It looks as if this request is for a project that the Community Housing Trust is involved in. They're basically asking to amend some heights within the project on a certain parcel, amend the maximum lot size, and change some language on how the housing is calculated for parts of development. I think the idea is that development that wants to happen on that parcel or that is proposed has a certain footprint to it and height that is already determined by other projects that have happened. Now, as this process has happened and gone through the Planning Commission has actually forwarded a negative recommendation for this project to the council. It's a recommendation at this point, so the council has to make a determination.
Okay, and is it primarily having to do with the height adjustments?
I think it's a combination of things. As has been debated in this overall Silver Creek Village project before, the distribution of affordable housing has been an issue with the Planning Commission and the council. Heights have been an issue. It's very specifically with heights. If you look within the development agreement, there's generally language that talks about the higher density and higher height buildings are in the center of the development, and it gets less dense and lower height buildings as it goes towards the edge of the development. This property this parcel within this development is on the edge of the property. So there are some conflicts within the development agreement language and what the developer is proposing. So that's why they're asking for these changes to the development agreement language, and we'll see how the council weighs in on that.
Okay, great. Anything else that you want to comment on?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, we're a little sad at the county this week. One of our past county commissioners, Sheldon Richens, passed away earlier this week. We've decided to honor his life by lowering our flags at county facilities for the next week. And so you'll see that out at our county facilities. And that's the reason why we're honoring his life.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much, Tom. Appreciate you calling in.
Appreciate it. Thank you a lot.
Bye now.
Carolyn.
Well, as the Utah legislature recently met in special session, relooking at the state's budget after only 3 months, a major question for the Park City Chamber Bureau was the state's tourism marketing dollars. Chamber Director Bill Malone brought us up to speed in his latest visit with KPCW. Rip Ruff has more on this.
Malone said the actions of the lawmakers left the tourism dollars pretty much at the same level, some $24 million.
The legislature went back in and looked at that $24 million and basically reallocated about $12 million of that for other uses, and then backfilled that $12 million with $12 million of CARES funding that the state is allocating now. So it was basically a wash in terms terms of the 12 out, 12 in, and still at the $24 million level. And obviously, it's something that the legislature and the governor feels that's important in terms of from an economic recovery standpoint.
He said the Park City Chamber Bureau is asking for about $275,000, the same amount they've received previously. Whatever funds they get, he said it has to be spent by the end of the calendar year. On some related news, Malone said the legislature set up several entities that can help out nonprofits or small business.
With GoEd, there's a $25 million impacted business grant program for nonprofits and small businesses. There's a cultural assistance grant program that just came out of the legislature for $9 million. There's PPE support for another $5 million for small businesses. So there's a variety of tools that are being rolled out from these legislative sessions to help small businesses.
Park City Chamber Bureau Executive Director Bill Malone. For KPCW, I'm Rick Brough.
Good morning. It's 8:29, and you're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Next on our show, we have a discussion about child care facilities. We have PC Tots founder and board chair Carol Loomis and Brandy Rasmussen, executive director and owner of both the Creekside Kids Academy and the Peak Program. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Glad to be here.
So,
thank you.
So let's start off. Brandy, you've been open a couple of weeks now. We have a new ordinance in place requiring masks in public locations. How is this and all the other safety protocols that you've got in place working for you with your facilities being open?
It's quite a challenge, quite honestly. And we're trying to figure out what to do each and every day. The regulations change regularly, and we're just trying to do the best we can with what we have.
So what are the biggest challenges?
The biggest challenges is the moving target, quite frankly. Everything tends to change regularly, so we're keeping track of what we need to be doing, making sure that that doesn't conflict with our licensing rules, which a lot of them do, and then really just trying to make sure that we've got inclusivity in the classroom so that we can make sure that everybody can follow the same rules and the same protocols.
And are you at full capacity right now, or?
No. We're at about 70% between the two schools.
Okay. What are you hearing from parents so far about all the circumstances and that type of thing?
I think parents are worried, and moving as quickly as the orders come into place is hard for them, and adjusting to what we need to do. The mask order has been really difficult for our parents and families, just trying to figure out how to make that work in a classroom with children of the ages that we serve.
And do the children have to wear masks? Is that part of the requirement?
According to the order, children over 2 do have to wear masks.
Okay. And your programs, you have 2 of them. You've got the Creekside Kids Academy and the Peak Program. Can you kind of define the differences there?
So Creekside Kids Academy, we serve children from 6 weeks to 12 years old. And at the Peak Program, we have children 2 to 12.
Okay. And how many kids right now are you having to enforce mask wearing? Do you have an idea?
Well, it's really difficult in the classroom, quite frankly, when it comes to putting a mask on a child. Obviously, just the challenge of having them keep it on. But the bigger challenge that I have is that we have a lot of exemptions for students in pretty much most of my classrooms. I've got students that have exemptions. So how to manage the students that have the exemptions where they aren't required to wear masks or they need a teacher that isn't wearing a mask is very difficult, because you then basically have one child or one teacher that doesn't wear the mask and the rest of the students are supposed to. Having enough masks for all the students, they didn't have them all. So we've kind of gone a different direction, and I've got an exemption from Summit County to order the face shields that are clear, that kind of can accommodate all of our students. We haven't gotten them yet. We ordered them on Saturday, and we're waiting for those to arrive to see how that's going to work. And we're hoping it works, but I'm not sure how they'll fit the children and how they'll do about keeping them on. And obviously we're not going to keep them on when they're sleeping. The reason we did the shields was really to help with, kids being able to have access to eating and drinking throughout the day regularly as they need it. Keeping the teachers from having to handle masks, keeping the children from
swapping masks or, you know, touching each other's masks or putting them on inside out. And, you know, there's a lot of, technically, I guess I would say they're kind of biohazard materials and we're not treating them that way. There's a lot of risk in that. So I think the shields, I hope the shields will provide a safer environment for everybody, a more inclusive environment for everybody. But there's obviously going to be the challenges, and we don't know what those are because they change regularly. We haven't gotten them to see who they'll fit and how they'll work, but we're hoping that we have some success there.
Sure. And Carol Loomis, we have also on the line. She is a founder of PC Tots and chair of PC Tots. And Carol, you're opening tomorrow.
Yes, we are opening tomorrow. It was a difficult decision, and the issue with PC Tots is that our mission is to provide quality, affordable childcare for Park City's workforce. And since people have gone back to work, we have parents who are desperate to have childcare. So we made the difficult decision to open. It has cost us about $25,000 in mitigation for the virus on requirements, because one of our buildings had quite open classrooms, and we've had to build like 6-foot walls between some of the classrooms, and we've added MERV 13 filters to the HVAC. We've put in tower fans in every room. We have to make sure the screens and windows open well so that we can get a lot of airflow. So we're also challenged by the mask ruling, and I think what Brandy's describing, the difficulty for the childcare industry here, is that we're getting in between the state licensing, which is under the State Department of Health, and then we have our local state department, local county Department of Health, and that one will defer to the other, but we can't count it. Then sometimes it's the state that we're supposed to listen to, and sometimes it's the county. Now the county has the mask provision for children 2 through 5, and we just found that out just as we're getting ready to open. So it's going to be that's going to be a challenge. We had already decided to have our teachers would be wearing masks, but one of the things I guess we would like to see is to have that we have parents anecdotally telling us that their children who are, the masks are frightening to them. The feeling is frightening, that, so it's something they're not used to, and, it's a trauma, can be traumatizing. So that's, it's quite a big discussion now in the whole childcare industry nationally about that. And so we'd like to see some from this, county, if we're going to be required to do that, they do some positive mask messaging for the county so that you could see pictures of kids and parents wearing masks and they're like superheroes or something. You know, something that gave it a positive spin. So since we're going to be going for it, our understanding is that they're going to re-evaluate that ruling in 2 weeks. So I guess we'll be being interviewed to see how that turns out.
So let me ask this: is it mostly the mask ordinance that is causing this disruption and this difficulty with the children?
I don't think. I think the whole, just the fact that we're living in a pandemic is what the disruption is. It's a very concerning, because we certainly don't want to be spreading virus, and yet we've got our, you know, parents are out in the community and they're servicing our community members. We have a strict health, each parent family, we're asked that no parents will be coming into the center. They will drop their children at the door. There'll be a health check to see if they have any of the symptoms of the virus. There'll also be temperature checks of the parent and the child. And we're temperature checking all of our teachers before they come in and doing health checks. So it isn't just the mask, or just a symptom of the bigger issue, because we want to do whatever we need to do to make this, to keep our teachers healthy and keep our children healthy.
Yeah, sure. And Brandy?
I think the biggest challenge, it's all of those things make it difficult. But one of the biggest things is the foundation of what we do is teaching children to share and to, you know, we're working on their social emotional development in their interaction. And yet here we've gone from working for years, teaching them to work together, to share, to be kind and be in the same space and take turns. And now we're telling them you can't use the same crayons and you can't touch the same toys and you need to stay 6 feet apart. And, you know, so it's a different game, and we're going against the very foundations of what we've been teaching them to do. So that's been difficult for everyone. And the kids need that interaction, and they need that social emotional piece is such an important part of their development.
Yeah.
And that's probably the biggest challenge. But I think as far as parents are concerned, yeah, the masks are kind of the big one, because that changes a lot inside the classroom as well. And that's really the one that the kids are going to feel on site.
Well, and let me ask this. Child care facilities are pretty notoriously very costly operations. Caregivers are also underpaid as a rule. Has this pandemic shed new light on these issues for working families? I mean, will these added costs, Carol, like the $25,000,
will that
have to be?
I would like to address that, because the child care in this country is facing extinction. There are child care businesses going out of business, and the fact that they've been shut down, they can't afford to be. That usually the on a good year, if you're running a business as a for-profit business, they make between 4% and 9% profit, and that's on a good year. And there aren't many good years, so it's an extremely expensive business, and it's also one of the most critical in our country. That a child's brain, 80% to 90% of a child's brain is developed by age 3. So it's critical that there's quality and education, early education, because that's what's going on, and for those children. And we are entrusted with those children starting at 6 weeks in our care center, as is Brandy. So it is a very critical issue, and I think it is coming to the awareness of the state government, I see, because they are making some grants that are helping us pay for the cost of mitigation. They're going to help us pay for the number of students we are down because of the required mitigation. For example, PC Talks, if we had everyone coming back, we couldn't even take 20% of them, because we have to drop that enrollment because to keep more distance between children. And right now we are running probably only at 35%. That's what we're opening with our from what we had. So we will be running financially at a deficit.
Well, and what are the other parents who need childcare services doing then? I mean, you've got another 65% then of your parents that are not able to.
And some of them are leaving them with family. One family told me that if we didn't open up, their family leave would be up, and one of them would have to quit their job and stay home for child care. So I think people, some of them haven't been called back to work, but a number have been called back to work. And we were getting tremendous pressure to open up. And especially we are serving the low income as well as other families. But the low income families, many of those did not close down. They were still working. And we also have families who are working in the healthcare industry and are first responders. So those families are desperate to have child care as well.
Sure. And just in our previous interview with Tom Fisher, Summit County Manager, he did mention that there's a tranche of funding. Are either of your organizations eligible for any of those funds to help through this difficult time?
I think they're just finding out about that. So we will be watching. We're watching and listening for any possibilities of funding. We were fortunate they were able to get PPE, and I believe Brandy had the same experience. So we have some help with that. And we've had, as a nonprofit, we've had generous help from Park City Municipal Corporation and the county and the Park City Community Foundation. And so because we already, if we were running with our usual 114 children, that would be 11 hours a day, and that would be every weekday of the year except for seven holidays. Even then, we were having to raise about $250,000 just to subsidize the children that came from low-income families. So we're looking for any possible financial help.
Sure.
Well, and Carolyn, the only thing that I've been aware of from Summit County was they did a $5,000 grant that we could apply for to help pay for the cost of some of the PPE cleaning things that they had changed, some of the changes that they required. So they did a grant for that. But that was early on that they did that. And then they've made quite a few changes since then that have required similar costs, quite frankly. And I haven't seen anything outside of that first initial $5,000 from the county.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it here. We've run out of time, but it sounds like this is a very uncertain time for childcare and how to make these businesses operations run efficiently, effectively, and safely. So good luck tomorrow, Carol, with your opening. And
thank you.
Hopefully we'll stay in touch and get updates from time to time on just how things are going.
Let's do that. We'll appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn.
That's Carol Loomis with PC Tots and Brandy Rasmussen, Executive Director and Owner of Creekside Kids Academy. It's 8:45. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour, and our final guest this morning is John Gay, who has worked with Deer Valley since the first days of operation. And I guess we're looking at almost 40 years in the ski industry. And I have John Gay on the line. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I hear you're retiring from the director of skier services.
Yeah, I am actually. I've just got a few days left here. I'll be here through Friday, and then I'm taking some time off.
Okay, and you're leaving as the skier services director. Can you just talk a little bit about what that job has involved?
Sure. You know, I started with Deer Valley in '81, and I was hired as an on-snow ski school supervisor, hired by Sal Rayo, who was the first director. And under Sal's guidance, it grew from a ski school and a really small child care center into a division that gradually took over ski rental. It became a very large children's center with a licensed portion and lift ticket sales as well. So Sal retired in 2002, right after the Olympics, and I was promoted into the director spot at that point in time and kind of tried to fill his shoes.
So you were there, according to some of the information I've read, you were there on December 26, 1981, which was the first day of opening. Is that right, with Deer Valley?
Yes, I was.
So tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Well, yeah, it was kind of interesting, actually. You know, we had gone through, we'd been hired, obviously, and gone through some company training and got to, you know, actually hear Edgar Stern speak about his vision and guest service and so on and so forth. But until you really open the doors and the guests show up and you're kind of in the front lines, I'm not sure if you were, any of us were really quite certain how it was all going to go. But, you know, we had a small ski school. We had, I think, 23 instructors plus Sal and myself. And we were pretty busy right out of the gate. High demand for lessons, you know, families on vacation, who mom and dad like to take privates and the kids in group lessons, and it just took off from there. I think the second December, we did as much business as we did the entire first season, and things just kind of kept rolling.
So that is a long time to be associated with one organization. What kind of changes would you point out to those of us listening, maybe who weren't even born then? Not that I'm saying I wasn't born. I was born, but many of our listeners weren't. So what has changed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it was pre-computers, you know, so we were working with, you know, paper and pencil essentially and telephones. I was in charge of scheduling the instructors and taking reservations and scheduling them. And I literally had a binder that had every day of the season in there with the instructors' names going down the page and the time of day. And I would write the reservations in pencil. And when things canceled, I would erase it out and try to keep up with the whole process. But the kind of the format we were using and how we rotated instructors and met the guest needs actually became kind of a template for the computer programs that we have right now. You know, we hired an independent programmer probably around 88 or so, late 80s, kind of wrote our first system for point of sale and, you know, scheduling and reservations and so forth. And we've been lucky that we've had on-site programmers for the last, you know, 39 years developing our system. So that part of it's been kind of fun. You know, I think the core business, though, is very much the same as it was that first year in terms of trying to offer very, very high-level guest service, trying to have an uncrowded experience and have a limited capacity, and having some of the five-star elements. I mean, food obviously was a cornerstone of Edgar's vision. But, you know, I think every division here tries to figure out what is five-star service in their particular area, whether it's ski school or ski rental or the children's center and so forth.
Yeah, sure. So what do you think about the stability of the industry itself and things that maybe never will change?
Well, I mean, what we're going through right now with COVID is obviously pretty scary for businesses, you know, all kinds of businesses and all across the world. I think Altera is doing the same process that is probably happening next door at Vail or any other ski resort right now, which is trying to get through this summer with very limited, you know, revenue and business open and be stable to open the doors next winter. And next winter, obviously, is a big question mark in terms of how much capacity we're going to be able to have and how much product we're going to be able to offer. But the hope is to be stable and get through this period and get back to, what will be a new normal. What that looks like, you know, will it be exactly the same as we had prior to COVID? Maybe not. I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out.
And the first Saturday in December is still the planned opening day then for the 2021 season?
Yes, it is. We are definitely planning an opening. There have been a lot of work groups over the last few months, you know, kind of analyzing, you know, kind of new protocols for guests coming in and staff members. We're certainly in the middle of running some summer operations now. We opened last Friday. And it is quite a lot different, you know, limited capacity, trying to social distance, trying to have, you know, the sanitation and all the procedures in place to keep your staff members safe and keep the guests safe.
Yeah, and recently the tourist visa or the worker visas have been terminated. What kind of impact will that have for your ski school? I mean, typically you bring in a lot of young people who come in to work for the resort and work as instructors.
We do have some instructors on visas. The larger group for the company are the J-1 students that are work and travel, and they work in food and beverage in our lift ticket office and childcare. And so that will be a kind of a challenge if we're not able to get those kids here. We also have some professional visas, the H2B. We have some ski instructors on that. A bit smaller group. And we even with COVID and high unemployment, some of those positions we anticipate could be challenging to fill. The people that are unemployed across the country, you know, how many of them will actually move their families to a ski town for the winter is a pretty big question mark.
Yeah. So who's taking over your role? Because that'll be their problem, won't it?
Yeah, I guess that there will always be challenges, right? The position has not been filled yet. We've got some strong internal candidates, and there was quite a bit of interest from outside Deer Valley as well. So Todd Shallon has been doing some preliminary interviews and screenings. I think he'll narrow the list and get the directors involved with a little bit smaller group of applicants. And so we will see who, you know, takes the position from that process.
Yeah, and I guess Deer Valley is one of the few resorts, mountain resorts, that has not succumbed to the financial and social pressures of the snowboarding industry. It's remained a ski-only resort. What are your thoughts on that, and what do you see happening in the future?
Well, you know, from a personal level, I love to snowboard. My kids grew up in town here. My older son only snowboards, and my younger boy skis, and you know, we as a family get together and enjoy the winter. And but for Deer Valley, the skiing only was part of that vision that Edgar had as a unique experience. And to be honest, it's worked for us. There's definitely enough demand and enough people that enjoy a skiing only mountain that I don't see it changing. The overwhelming feedback we get is that people are willing to pay a premium to come to a skiing only resort.
Sure. Let's talk about what's next for you.
Well, you know, I think like everybody who kind of gets to that retirement age, you know, you're certainly looking forward to some time to myself and my family, being able to travel a little bit. I love to go kiteboarding. So we're going to take off and go to the Northwest with the camper for a couple of months. And I will continue to ski and you know, have my home here in Park City. And I also love winter snow kiting. And Utah's got some of the best winter snow kiting around. So I think I'll be busy with my hobbies. And I've also got a couple of grandkids. My older boy his family's actually been living with us for the last 6 months or so. They're building a house over in Midway, and we've got a couple of grandkids. We've got a 15-month-old little girl and a 5-year-old. So they're keeping us busy as well.
Oh, well, that sounds really great. Yeah, anything else that you'd like to say about your experience with Deer Valley over the years?
You know, I feel really, really fortunate that I was able to, you know, kind of be in on the ground floor and the startup of a really successful business. You know, I think a world-class business. And I think the people that have been here, the people that have stuck with it, I mean, there was a lot of turnover in the early years and people that really weren't probably the right fit for this type of company. But the ones that stuck it out and the ones that, you know, kind of poured their hearts and souls into it are some great people. And the group from the first year is getting to be a little bit small now, but we have so many people that have been here for 20, 25 years. And just my thanks to all the frontline staff, to my managers that worked in Skier Services, the director group, just a really, really great resort.
Yeah. Do I hear a little emotion?
Maybe just a little bit, yeah.
Just a little bit. Well, that's really great to hear. And we wish you the best in everything you're pursuing this summer. It sounds like it's a fun summer coming along with grandkids and kiting and all those great things to do.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to coming back and doing some skiing as well. People will definitely see me on the slopes.
Okay. Well, thanks again for joining us, John Gay, retiring after 40 years with Deer Valley. Appreciate you coming on this morning.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Bye now. It's 8:58. Hey, stay with us this morning on This Green Earth. Dr. Enric Sala, a National Geographic Explorer in Residence and author of the forthcoming book, The Nature of Nature, talks about Pacific kelp forests, often referred to as the redwoods of the sea. These underwater forests have shown to have a wide variety of positive impacts, ranging from purifying water for marine life, serving as a protective nursery for young species, reducing coastal erosion, and even lowering methane emissions when fed to cows. But a combination of marine heat waves, pollution, and overfishing has wiped out more than 90% of kelp in certain areas of California. Dr. Sala discusses how we can reduce those risks by making more space for nature and natural habitat. And that will be on This Green Earth this morning, right after NPR News at 9 a.m. We are looking at a 45 degrees here in Park City with showers likely today, a high of just 59. Tonight, a chance of showers, low of 42. Wednesday, sunshine, high of 73 in Park City. Sunshine on Thursday, a high of 77. Friday, sunny with a high of 79. And Independence Day, a high of 81 degrees. And in Heber City, we'll quickly give you an update. It's 46 degrees there with a light drizzle and a slight chance of showers this afternoon. And tonight, a low of 37 degrees, a high of 79 tomorrow with sunshine. Thursday, high of 86, sunshine. Friday, high of 88, chance of showers in the afternoon. And Independence Day, a high of 90 with sunshine all day long. We are going to take you back to NPR. Thank you for listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray, and I was in for Leslie Thatcher this morning.